Stay tuned now for Dr. Steven Zelikoff and a program you will not want to miss. Bone Talk. That's Bone Talk with Dr. Steven Zelikoff on 1460 WVOX.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Bone Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Steven Zelikoff. And today we're very fortunate to have Dr. Christian Brotea, who's an orthopedic spine specialist, who's going to be talking with us about cervical spine issues, neck pain, and what you need to know and what can you do to make it better. Dr. Brotea is head of spine surgery at Montefiore and Rochelle. He's trained at the Cleveland Clinic and has had many, many years of experience in dealing with complex cervical and lumbar spine issues, scoliosis, fractures, and has a wealth of experience that he's brought to specialty orthopedics as practice and also to surrounding hospitals. He has privileges in many regional hospitals, including Montefiore and Rochelle, Westchester Medical Center, Lawrence. And again, his practice, and you can reach him at specialtyorthony.com or at specialtyorthopedics at 914-686-0111. So, Dr. Brotea, welcome, and thanks again for coming on Bone Talk.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Of course. So, we're going to be talking today about the cervical spine. What is the cervical spine?
So, look, so basically, when you're talking about the cervical spine, you're talking about the neck. The role of the cervical spine is to basically protect your spinal cord and to support your head. It's supposed to allow you to move your head, to support the weight of the head. It allows you to tilt forward, tilt backwards, turn to the left, turn to the right. The other role of the cervical spine is to protect, besides the spinal cord, the vertebrae, the blood supply, basically, that supplies the brain. So it's got it has a very important role. And as such, unfortunately, it's also affected by a number of conditions, a number of things that ultimately people see us in the office for.
Now, given the fact that the neck allows the head to move in so many different directions and has so much flexibility, I'm sure that all those muscles that help do that can also get tight and run to various injuries as well.
Right. So when patients come in complaining or with complaints of neck pain, spasms, 90% of the time the symptoms are related to muscular damage. There's also an element of ligamentous damage that can occur around this cervical spine that can also lead to pain. One of the most commonly injured elements of the cervical spine are the discs, which are the shock absorbers or the cushions between the vertebrae. The cervical spine is a total of 6 discs positioned between the 7 cervical vertebrae, and they allow your head to flex forward, extend backwards, rotate. Excessive motion, like in a car accident or if you sustain a fall or any type of trauma, can cause those discs to rupture. They can cause herniations of the discs, which is another very common condition.
Now, what are the common diseases and disorders that affect your cervical spine?
So one of the most common things that we see, besides the neck pain that we just went over, is what's called cervical radiculopathy. So that happens when you have a cervical nerve, one of the nerves exiting your cervical spine, that's pinched by a disc herniation, by a bone spur, or something else pushing on it. That can cause numbness, tingling, weakness, pain, symptoms which typically extend to the shoulders and down to the upper extremities, the arms. Sometimes you may only have a finger involved or a fingertip, but in general, the symptoms extend all the way up and down the arm and can consist, like I said, of weakness or numbness.
Now, how do you know? I mean, you know, most of us with neck pain and neck symptoms, I mean, we're seeing a lot more of that, particularly as people are constantly on their iPhones and their necks are kind of like benched over, and also with repetitive work things, I mean, they find that they get a lot of tightness. They may get a little bit of tingling in their hands and fingers. How do they know if this is something that's carpal tunnel or if this is where you get more injuries from your wrist, or how do they know if this is coming from their neck?
So typically that's something that a lot of these conditions can overlap, and they can present very similarly. So that's something that basically requires a visit to a specialist, which includes a physical exam. So basically by examining the patient, testing the different nerves exiting the spine, we can help determine that. It can involve obtaining imaging. So if you can send somebody for an X-ray, the most common and most helpful imaging modality that we have is an MRI, which basically uses a large magnet and radio waves and a computer to produce detailed images of the cervical spine anatomy. So the scan can show us in detail the extent, if any, of degeneration, i.e. arthritis, wear and tear of the neck, and as a result, the pinching of the nerves or the spinal cord. We can also obtain X-rays. Those are quick studies that we can usually procure them in an office-type setting. If we're looking at somebody who has significant numbness or weakness, muscle atrophy, we can also send them for an EMG or nerve study, which basically involves, it helps evaluate the health and the function of nerves and muscles. And basically, it looks at the how fast the electrical impulse can move through the nerve. If the nerve is pinching the neck, that typically leads to a slowdown of the nerve conduction at the level of the neck. If it happens in the wrist, like a carpal tunnel syndrome type situation, the nerve conduction slows down at the level of the wrist. There are other modalities that are used less commonly. A CAT scan typically is a great study to look at bone anatomy, and it's a quick study that can be obtained usually in an emergency type situation where you're trying to rule out a neck fracture. But there are a multitude of studies and imaging and nerve conduction study-wise that can help us narrow down the diagnosis and figure out the cause of the symptoms.
Now, regarding patients with cervical radiculopathy where they get numbness or tingling and the neck pain that you had mentioned before, most of these, I guess, are associated with, is it a problem that the discs are the problem and that they have cervical disc disease, or is it a problem that they develop arthritis in their neck that's creating less space for the nerve roots?
So whenever you're looking at somebody with numbness, tingling down the arm that's due to the neck, that implies some kind of nerve irritation, nerve pinching. The most common reason for a pinched nerve in somebody younger would be a disc herniation, which basically implies a rupture or a piece of disc coming out of place and applying pressure on the nerve, which leads to the numbness and weakness. And as you get older and the spine begins to degenerate, so you're dealing with an arthritic condition, and by arthritic condition, we're talking about wear and tear of the disc, disc bulges, bone spurs, sort of disc collapse, all these degenerative arthritic changes that happen to the spine, they all lead ultimately to narrowing of the spinal canal, narrowing of the openings, which are called the nerve lamina, where the nerves exit the spine. And all that narrowing causes ultimately pinching. So in somebody with a picture of arthritis, degeneration, wear and tear of the spine, the most common reason for a pinched nerve would be the arthritis, right? So, but it all comes down to pinching of the nerve or irritation of the nerve.
Now, as far as, I mean, is there a congenital component of this, or is this something that just purely degenerative over time?
So, again, the cause of the pinching is narrowing. Now, like I said, most of the time the narrowing is due to arthritis, degenerative changes as we get older. In some cases, the narrowing is due to herniations or rupture of a disc,
right.
Sometimes because of a fracture, sometimes because of a tumor or an infection. But in some cases, patients are born with narrowing, and it's called congenital stenosis. So they can present with narrowing from birth of the spinal canal. So those patients are more predisposed to having symptoms because they're starting off with a narrow canal to begin with.
Now, when people say they have spinal stenosis, that's a very common thing, and most people, I think, have heard of spinal stenosis more in their lumbar spine, which is in the lower back area.
Right.
Is it pretty much the same thing in the cervical spine? I mean, is it the same pathology, or is it different in the cervical spine than the lumbar spine?
So the pathology is actually the same. So stenosis means narrowing. Again, this is the most important concept that ultimately, again, accounts for most of the symptoms. So the narrowing in the lower back that causes, that's called stenosis. It can also occur in the neck. And the cause of this is the same. Typically, degeneration, wear and tear, bone spurs, disc bulges, or like I was saying before, you can have a disc herniation or something else pushing on the opening, the spinal canal. And that's, again, that's called stenosis. So you, it's just as common in the neck as it is in the lower back. It's more publicized in the lower back, mostly because patients present with sciatica, which is another very common, sort of commonly denominated condition.
Now, people oftentimes will present with sciatica, and they kind of just have a little bit of numbness down their leg and eventually sort of resolves with conservative modalities. Is it pretty much the same thing if you get all of a sudden you get numbness, tingling, weakness in your hand or arm? Is there greater urgency with the neck than it is with the lower back in terms of seeking out medical care?
In general, no. The chance of it getting better on its own is actually pretty good. So patients are statistically likely to get better on their own with some physical therapy maybe or an injection, some anti-inflammatory medications, a muscle relaxer. So patients are statistically likely to get better on their own with conservative treatment, whether it's a neck or a back condition. Now, there are certain conditions, and these are pretty rare, and it comes back to the stenosis we're talking about. There are certain conditions that lead to pinching of the spinal cord. The problem with pinching of the spinal cord, which is different from pinching a nerve that goes down the arm, pinching of the spinal cord may be completely asymptomatic. So patients may have what's called spinal cord compression and not have any symptoms or just have very mild neurologic symptoms. Pinching of the spinal cord can lead to, and again, in the absence of pain, it can lead to upper lower extremity, arms, legs, numbness, weakness, balance issues, subtle neurologic findings that otherwise may go undiagnosed. A pinching or stenosis, cervical stenosis that's causing impingement of the spinal cord, that's something that needs to be followed closely and ultimately may lead to surgical intervention. So that's sort of in its own category, and it has to be thought of whenever we look at a patient.
So changes in balance that are acute, that are sort of rapidly changing, things of that nature, overall lower extremity and upper extremity weakness, those are things that people really should seek out medical care for very quickly.
Well, yes, and the problem is there are numerous causes for all of these symptoms, so it has to be sorted out. One of the set of the causes would have to do with your cervical spine, but the truth is there are multiple causes for this. So when somebody's experiencing neurologic issues, numbness, weakness, balance loss, dexterity problems, these all should be investigated first by following up with a primary care physician, possibly seeing a spine surgeon or a neurologist. So it's something that you have to keep an eye out for.
So what are the non-surgical treatment options for cervical spine conditions in general?
So like I said, 90% of patients with a neck condition, whether it's a strained muscle, a strained ligament, a pinched nerve, 90% of patients get better with time. They get better on their own. They get better with conservative treatment. Now, conservative treatment, the most common one would be physical therapy, chiropractic care. The second most common one would be, if symptoms warranted, a pain management consultation where you follow up the pain management specialist, they look at your MRI, they look at your anatomy, and they consider an injection, a steroid injection. The reason why steroid injections help is because they're basically an anti-inflammatory. So a pain management specialist will give you a certain amount of steroid that would be injected close to the inflamed or irritated nerve, and technically speaking, that steroid will help calm down the inflammation and help with the symptoms. Again, 90% of patients get better with conservative treatment. A small percentage of patients, however, they don't respond to conservative treatment. And they have intractable pain. They can have progressive numbness, weakness, muscle atrophy, neurologic findings. And those patients, if the pathology is there, may ultimately need surgery.
So what are the surgical treatment options that are available for cervical spine conditions when they do need surgery?
So the most common procedure that we perform in the neck when it comes to surgery would be a decompression maneuver. So the idea is you have something that's getting pinched, that's getting irritated. So you can go ahead and from a posterior approach, you go from the back of the neck or you go from the front of the neck, and you shave off disc, you shave off bone, you're basically scraping off some of that arthritis or whatever the pathology may be, and you take the pressure off the nerves or off the spinal cord. And that's called the decompression. Sometimes if we have to do an extensive enough of a decompression, so we have to remove enough bone or disc material, we also have to fuse things. A fusion, which has a bad reputation, but basically a fusion is a stabilization procedure, which in some patients is absolutely needed because that instability, that lack of coordinated movement in the cervical spine can cause intractable pain. So a fusion procedure is where we go in with instrumentation, whether it's angled screws or rods, with bone graft, and try to achieve stability of the cervical spine. Because again, like we were saying in the beginning, the cervical spine, the main role of the cervical spine is to protect the nerves and to protect the spinal cord. And if you're dealing with instability or lack of, like I said, coordinated motion, that can lead to compromise of the spinal cord and the nerves, and that's when you end up with problems.
Go ahead.
No, so like I was going to say, so the primary thing that we usually perform, the most common surgery would be a decompression. The second most common one would be a decompression and then a stabilization pack procedure.
Now, when you have a cervical discectomy or a laminectomy and a fusion, what can patients expect after the surgery in terms of loss of function, loss of rotation and movement? Because I guess if you're fusing part of the vertebrae, how much rotational movement are they losing, or how much motion are they losing of their neck, if any? And what can they expect in terms of just going back to activities afterwards?
So it depends on the approach for the surgery, whether we go from the front or we go from the back, and obviously the extent of it. As far as the fusion is concerned, and that's probably one of the most common questions that we get, is to what degree am I going to lose range of motion of the neck if I undergo a fusion procedure? So most of the time, I'd say over 80-85% of the time that we do the procedure, the fusion is performed on segments of the cervical spine that have already lost most of their normal motion. So the discs that we typically remove, the bone spurs that we usually move out of the way or we scrape off, the bone that we remove, those are all segments of the cervical spine that have lost natural range of motion. So when you go ahead and you stabilize it properly with spacers, with screws, the bone graft, and all the stuff that we talked about, the range of motion that you ultimately lose is minimal. Because, again, you're starting off before the surgery with segments of the cervical spine that are not functioning properly. Now, on the other hand, if you have a young, very flexible neck, and you're in a, let's say, got in a car accident or some kind of trauma, and you need to have your neck stabilized, then obviously that's something that you go from a fully moving neck and a fully flexible cervical spine to a fused neck, then that's something that's more noticeable. But for most patients who undergo the procedures for underlying arthritic degenerative conditions, which lead to stiffness as it is, they're not going to notice a significant loss of range of motion. Now, the expectations are that after the surgery, they will need to undergo extensive physical therapy sometimes, exercises, strengthening. But most patients, especially after an anterior approach of the spine, are able to return back to normal activities within 4 to 6 weeks. For a more extensive procedure where we go from the back of the spine, so the dissection is somewhat larger, I would say 2 to 3 months. Bone healing can take a long time to take place, But most patients start feeling much better, I would say, within weeks of the surgery.
How long does it take to regain back your muscle strength? And also, how much can you expect that the numbness and tingling will resolve after surgery?
So the goal of the surgery is basically to free up the nerves that have been getting pinched or affected and have led to the numbness and tingling and weakness. Once you free up those nerves, depending on how long they have been under duress, or for how long they've been sort of compromised, they are expected to some degree to improve. Now, that doesn't always happen because whenever a nerve is getting pinched or affected in some way, it can lead to chronic nerve damage, and those things may not necessarily improve even with a successful surgery. So I would say 90% of patients experience significant nerve function return within the first few weeks of the surgery, but sometimes it can take 2 or 3 months, depending on how long they've had the symptoms.
So that's very good to know. And so if you're starting to get symptoms, the longer that you sort of hold off on doing something, the longer it's most likely going to take to recuperate from it.
Yeah, so basically there are two competing forces here. On one hand, you want to give your body a chance to recuperate from an injury, to get better, because like I said, most patients do get better. On the other hand, the longer a nerve is getting compromised, is getting affected, the higher the chance of that nerve becoming irreversibly damaged. So you have to follow these things very closely and figure out exactly at what point you want to approach this surgically and fix the underlying problem if your body doesn't do the job. That's really how I would look at it. Because otherwise, sort of slacking off on it and just letting it be can lead to irreversible nerve damage that no surgery or any type of intervention can fix.
Now, people talk about minimally invasive surgery all the time. And that's the buzzword that in what I do is the same thing. Is this a minimally invasive procedure, or, I mean, or is it just a term that people just throw around?
So all the anterior approaches to the neck, where we basically go from the front, they involve a very small, it's less than an inch long incision, horizontal incision, usually on the right side of the neck. And that gives us access to 2 or 3 of the discs in the neck, 2 or 3 of the segments of the neck, and gives us the opportunity to, with the help of a microscope and microinstruments, to basically remove the disc, put spacers in, free up those nerves, and achieve stability like we were planning on. Unfortunately, sometimes the arthritis is so extensive that it can only be approached from a posterior approach, which involves a bigger incision, and that's not minimally invasive. That bigger opening, if you will, that bigger incision gives us access to more of the spine and allows us to fix a lot more things. So while there's a downside, there's definitely a minimally invasive approach to the spine when you're talking about the cervical spine and going from an anterior approach. But sometimes, unfortunately, that's not enough. It does not give us enough of an opening to access all the areas we need to access to be able to achieve what we need to achieve when we're talking about a decompression or a fusion.
So when you need spine surgery, how do you decide whether you go to an orthopedic surgeon or whether you go to a neurosurgeon? What are your thoughts?
So when it comes down to spine surgery, you basically want to see a spine surgeon. So now there are different backgrounds when it comes to that. So you can have somebody who's orthopedic trained, orthopedic surgery trained, and does spine surgery, or you can have a neurosurgeon with a spine surgery background. Some places, and as a matter of fact, the Cleveland Clinic, where I do my training, some places are combined programs where they have orthopedic and neurosurgeons train, basically undergo the same training when it comes to the spine. So the idea is to find do your research and find a competent orthopedic or neurosurgeon spine-trained specialist who can perform the surgery.
So, again, we're on the phone today with Dr. Christian Brotea, who is an orthopedic spine specialist working out of Specialty Orthopedics in Harrison, New York. And once again, Dr. Brotea has had many, many years of experience in managing complex problems of the spine, including lumbar, thoracic, as well as the cervical spine, which we've been talking about today. We can get a lot of the great information that Dr. Brotea spoke about in today's section of Bone Talk on the website, which is www.specialtyorthony.com. Or you can reach Dr. Brotea at 914-686-0111 at Specialty Orthopedics. So in the final minutes of our segment, what would you like people to take away regarding cervical spine conditions?
So, again, remember, most of the conditions that, patients encounter are things that get better on their own. However, if the symptoms warranted, just have it followed up, especially if you're talking about not just pain, but you're talking about numbness, weakness, tingling, burning sensations. These are all things that can be reflective of an underlying nerve or spinal cord condition, and they have to be evaluated because, like I said before, they can lead to irreversible damage. So, in general, if you're talking about a mild strain or a sprain, those are the types of things that get better on their own. But if you're talking about neurologic issues, make sure you have that followed up either with your primary care physician, follow up with a spine surgeon, or a neurologist.
That's really wise thoughts. And, again, thank you so much for joining us on Bone Talk. That was Dr. Christian Brotea. And I'm Dr. Steven Zelikoff, thanking everybody for joining us today on another episode of Bone Talk.